morning, Cascadia. Today is Tuesday, February 2nd, 2010, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. And this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
The first thing you need to know is that in Gobbler's Knob, Pennsylvania today, Puck's attorney Phil emerged, saw his shadow, thus alerting an anxious nation to expect 6 more weeks of winter.
The federal budget also emerged from its den yesterday. Its shadow stretches all the way back to the Bush administration.
And in Oaxaca, 4 people were arrested for simply asking the governor a question about their friend, the murdered indie journalist Brad Will.
Portland area weather today, patchy clouds, slight chance of showers with a high around 53, moderate chemtrail activity. Tonight, 50% chance of rain and lows in the mid-40s. And tomorrow, pretty much the same, except a little more chance of rain.
And first we go to regional news from around Cascadia. We recently had Peter Schoonmaker of the Ilahi Institute as a guest on an extended form of Air Cascadia. The lecture series is beginning tonight with Jonah Lehrer. He is a contributing editor at Wired Magazine, the author of How We Decide, and Proust was a neuroscientist. He's written for The New Yorker, Nature, Seed, The Washington Post. I could go on and on and on. But let's talk instead with Jonah Lehrer. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you so much for joining us on the air today. So the first lecture is tonight. It is at the First Congregational Church. Begins at 7:30. Doors open at 6:30 for people who want to mingle and network and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about your concept of the decision-making process and why we need to understand it?
Well, you know, a lot goes on in your brain every time you make a decision. To make a long story short, there's a bit of an argument taking place as different brain areas respond to different parts of the world, and you've got all these competing interests. So making good decisions, I think, is about learning how to reconcile the argument in the right way. And when it comes to shifting the public and getting them to care about things like climate change or these important environmental issues, I think it's also important to understand how we make decisions in order to know how to sell what we're trying to sell. Marketers have for a long time, I think, taken advantage of some of the loopholes built into our brain. I think it's time to apply the same knowledge to perhaps better causes.
It's exactly the way any subversive movement has accomplished its goals. It was by co-opting the techniques of the opposition. When we come to make decisions, how do you balance? How do we understand how much is an individual internal process and how much of it is governed by the crowd?
Well, you know, that's a really important question that I think scientists have yet to really answer. I think one of the big limitations of current research is that we tend to study people in isolation. You know, we put them in brain scanners all by themselves. But I think everyone knows that the culture we grow up in, our parents, our friends, the mobs we're a part of, these profoundly influence our behavior. But we don't yet know exactly how that happens, how that works, at least in the brain. But I think we do know that the culture we're raised in has profound ramifications.
So let's just wait briefly before we let you go this morning. Tell listeners a bit about the lecture tonight. I know that the whole series is Power on Power and Change. How does decision making fit into the dynamics of power and change?
Well, I'll be talking a bit about how environmentalists and scientists can take these new findings in neuroscience that will help them hopefully better sell their research, better market it to the public so the public really understands why these issues, why these environmental issues are so important. But I'll be spending most of the talk talking about creativity. We've got all these really, really serious problems. We've dug ourselves into a really deep hole, and I think it's going to take some real human ingenuity to get ourselves out of it. So we'll be looking at some of the neuroscience behind creativity, behind innovation, behind human ingenuity. How can we use this new knowledge of the brain to help us become more creative and hopefully help us solve some of these problems that seem so intractable right now?
Thank you very much for that. We'll look forward to that this evening. Of course, this is at the First Congregational Church. We all have all of that information at the front desk here at KBOO. You can also go to the Ilahi website and find out more about Joan Albert, the lecture tonight, and the rest of the series. Thank you so much. My guest has been Joan Albert, contributing editor at Wired, author of How We Decide, and Proust was a neuroscientist. And, of course, much, much more. Again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It crash-landed yesterday on legislators' laps. The 2011 federal budget for Oregon, there was good and bad news. There's $50 million for work in East Side Forests, millions in loan guarantees for struggling small businesses, and aid for the Klamath Basin. Rural schools, water systems, and economic development got shortchanged. And there's no money to move the NOAA Pacific Fleet to Newport because the administration wants to resolve the dispute before committing money. Representative Greg Walden, Oregon's lone Republican in Congress, called the budget tone-deaf because it, quote, recklessly heaps another $1.6 trillion in new deficits on the American people, unquote, forgetting that the nation's deficit is a legacy of the lost years of the Bush administration. When Bush was in power, the left said it would take decades to undo the damage, and now the same voices are enraged that Obama hasn't done it all in the first year.
As the Oregon legislature's special February session dawns, the first order of business was extending unemployment insurance benefits to Oregon's nearly 19,000 unemployed whose benefits are about to run out. Demographics suggest that a huge percentage of these people hate the government for cramping their Hummer-driven style. Funny, isn't it, how the teabaggers hate the public sector until they need it.
Multnomah County's goal is to place 30 families in 30 homes. The main obstacle is getting enough landlords willing to rent to them, never mind the myth that Americans are basically good-hearted people. At this, the halfway point, the county has 36 families ready to move in, but only 10 landlords with 15 apartments willing to rent to them. That's why the county wants to make the choice easy. It guarantees rent through June 30th. They'll foot the bill for any damage, and it requires intensive case management for every tenant. Further, it selected only families likely to become self-sufficient in 6 months.
Yeah, and the sad irony always is, of course, that the very people who need jobs and housing the most are the ones most likely to be denied it. Oregon is still wrestling itself over the plastic bag issue. State Senator Mark Haas, Democrat of Beaverton, wants every store in Oregon to eliminate the bags. Haas is spearheading a bill that is up for hearing today in Salem that would outlaw single-use plastic bags at checkout. Paper bags would remain legal. More progressive states have had more success with the quest to rid themselves of plastic contamination. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality's expert on environmental impacts of products says that the agency has reservations about a plastic bag ban, given the impact of paper bags. Of course, the Oregon DEQ has a bit of a track record when it comes down to collusion with the private sector.
So President Barack Obama wants to save $1.2 billion over 10 years by eliminating payments to states and Indian tribes that have completed cleanup of abandoned coal mines. Obama calls the proposal common sense. Why pay states to clean up mines that have already been cleaned up? In other words, why pay people for doing their jobs after they've done them? Logical inconsistency and harebrained evil aside, lawmakers from mining states say they need the money to create jobs and to clean up other mines, including hard rock mines, that continue to pose a danger.
This seems like such a no-brainer. I feel like, am I missing something here? Okay. They've done it before, and they might do it again, only this time in earnest. The sister school district has always used wood pellets to heat its buildings, but if the school board approves the plan, the sisters could be the first district in the region to install a biomass heating system, beginning with its high school. The district says it might be able to do this without making any upfront investment. Instead, it would pay a set fee to a company called Energyneering, a local biomass company that desperately needs somebody to do a new name for them. The fee would be equal to the district's current heating costs, another way to redefine scraping the forest floor in preparation for commercial tree farming.
Gaming the rules or greening the grid. There's the rub. Wind energy is a good thing, certainly better than coal, biomass, or natural gas, but environmental groups point out that some wind developers try to game the system by splitting large projects into several smaller and adjacent projects, each under 105 megawatts to avoid state scrutiny. Under state rules, if a proposed project is under 105 megawatts in size, it goes through the local county to secure its land use permit. Larger projects must pass review by the Oregon Energy Facilities Siting Council. The group says the rules at the county level, where local officials are eager to draw the jobs and revenue wind projects can bring, can be more relaxed, putting wildlife and other resources at risk.
And now we go to international/U.S. news. Three American tourists and one Uruguayan citizen were arrested in Oaxaca City last Thursday after approaching Governor Ulis Rios in the city's Zocalo and asking him about the murder of indie media activist Brad Will. Andre Caraballo, Guadalupe Rodriguez-Lopez, James Wells, and Jennifer Lawhorn were eating ice cream in the Zocalo of Oaxaca. They recognized the Oaxacan gov and decided to ask about their friend Brad Will. He, of course, was the U.S. journalist who was killed in Oaxaca in 2006 while covering the uprising there. After a rather nasty afternoon and a long night in jail, presumably for refusing to cooperate, the four continued to demand their right to remain silent, and they demanded also their attorney be present. The following day, mirabile dictu, they were released for lack of evidence and no charges. One of the four says this. After traveling for half an hour, we arrived at the police headquarters of Santa Maria Coyotepec outside the Oaxacan city limits. Once we entered, the police took photographs of us and asked us questions. We demanded the presence of an attorney, which was denied by the police officials. We spent an hour surrounded by police with their faces covered with ski masks who humiliated and threatened us. Later, the police put us once again in the police truck, and without telling us where we were going, we left the headquarters. The truck stopped about half a block away from the State General's Institute of Justice. The police ordered us to leave our belongings in the darkness of the street. When we refused to do that, insisted by threatening us for half an hour while recording us with video. This went on for hours and the rest of the night, as I understand it from this press release, and they still have no idea what the charges were, if any. It was merely an exercise in intimidation.
Finally, a friend will help you move. A good friend will help you move a body. A Gold Bar, Washington man has pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder in the gruesome slaying of his ex-girlfriend. Prosecutors allege that Eric Christensen killed Sherry Carlin, dismembered her body, and asked a friend to drive him around parts of Snohomish County to dispose of the remains. Prosecutors say the friend eventually contacted investigators and led them to spots where body parts were recovered.
You'd think that it occurred to ask about this trip around town, dropping off bags. It would occur to him before, not after it had happened.
This has been Air Cascadia for Tuesday, February 2nd, 2010. Engineering is Janet Anderson. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. Chris Andre is the producer. I'm Liam Delta.
This has been Air Cascadia. News and comment on KBOO, your community radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, kboo.fm on the web. If you missed previous Air Cascadia programs, you can always catch up at kboo.fm.
Coming up next, Flashpoints, Kevin Pina from Haiti, and two legal experts on Obama giving a pass to the architects of the Bush torture plan.
Thanks for listening, thanks for your support, and have a good day.